Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
The infrastructure deal, done in a bipartisan way. But what will happen in the House? That's the big question. How unions can benefit? We'll get into that. And today on the show, the United Food and Commercial Workers and the Cement Masons, Local 633. Welcome to the Wednesday, August 11th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on five platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. We have two guests on the show today, newcomers to the show, I might add. Hugh Giordano will be our first guest, and he comes from the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 152. They have about 14,000 workers in retail stores across four states, and they are the official labor union, which represents cannabis workers from seed to sale, medical and adult use. Now, we're going to get into that. We'll also talk about the PRO Act and overall organizing. A little background on Hugh. His union interest was sparked when he was a student and employee at Philadelphia University. We're going back 20 years, 2001. It was there that he helped lead two organizing campaigns to unionize the dining service employees at the school, and he then encouraged his adjunct professors to speak to the American Federation of Teachers in order to organize. All right, at the age of 24, he ran for state rep in Pennsylvania and got the most votes of any third-party candidate in a three-way race. Then he became a member of UFCW Local 152 as a deli clerk at Brown ShopRite in Roxboro, Pennsylvania, while he finished college. That was in 05. And while working at Brown's, he interned with both Local 1776 and 152. Fast forward to today, Hugh is a union rep organizer for the local, meeting potential new members and encouraging unions across the tri-state region. He holds a bachelor's degree in business management from Philadelphia University and a master's in legal and ethical studies from the University of Baltimore. And most recently, Hugh helped pass major legislation in the state of New Jersey to make it easier for workers to join a union, specifically the cannabis workers, and we'll get into that. Yeah, there's a lot of growth in that field. Brian Farmer will be joining us later in the show, and Brian spent 24 years in the concrete industry, and he comes from the Operative Plasters and Cement Masons International Union. This is a historic union. They were organized when the Civil War was going on in this country. 1864. That's a long time for a union. He is the apprenticeship coordinator at Local 633. Website is training633.org, and they represent workers in Minnesota, North Dakota, and parts of Wisconsin. Brian has a diversity of skill sets ranging from flat work to architectural stamping and staining to polished floors and various coating systems. And he said he believes that apprenticeships are our foundation to the success of our trade. And that's what he's going to talk about on the show. Viable career paths and the importance of an apprenticeship. And we couldn't talk enough about that right now because there's so many jobs available in the trades. Good paying union jobs, great wages, fantastic benefits. And with the apprenticeship program, you earn while you learn. That's a big part of that. Boy, I talk about apprenticeship programs. We're going to need more because we have a lot of jobs that are going to be created. Well, it's not done yet. It did pass the Senate. We've been talking about this bipartisan infrastructure deal, but let me give you the components real quick. The bill would direct $550 billion in new federal spending toward infrastructure projects all around the country. All around the country, it would provide $65 billion to expand high-speed internet access. We touched on that yesterday with Frank Matthews of the CWA. That's big for the CWA. $110 billion for roads, bridges, and other projects. $25 billion for airports. And how about this? The most funding for Amtrak since the passenger rail service was founded 50 years ago, 1971. Now, passed the Senate. In fact, 19 Republicans voted for it. Trump tried to do everything to stop this. Said, you can't support the liberal Democratic agenda. And they turned their heads to him. Now, the legislation faces a very tricky path in the House, where Nancy Pelosi has repeatedly said she will not take it up until the Senate clears the reconciliation bill. Now, the reconciliation bill is more than three times the cost of what passed yesterday. It's $3.5 trillion. And it includes a lot. I mean, universal pre-K, free community college, a path to lawful permanent status for undocumented immigrants. Also, the child care tax credit that a lot of families started getting last month, $300 per month, per child, rather, each month. They want to extend that permanently. Now, is that going to pass? I don't think so. And I hope the House doesn't hold it up for that, you know, one step at a time. But getting back to what happened yesterday, I'm just going to run down more. I mentioned Amtrak, $1 billion for restoration of the Great Lakes, reconstruction of the Alaskan Highway, $73 billion to update the nation's electricity grid so it can carry more renewable energy. $7.5 billion to construct electric vehicle charging stations. $17.5 billion for clean buses and ferries. $15 billion for removing lead pipes. That's a huge issue, especially in the Michigan area with what happened in Flint some years back. It also includes money to restore lakes across the country. $66 billion in new funding for that. $350 million pilot program for projects that reduce collisions between vehicles and wildlife. That's interesting. Now, let's get back to that reconciliation bill. I know I'm bouncing around a little bit, but there's some interesting components in that legislation dealing with unions. First, Democrats intend to create some sort of tax credit or deduction for money spent on union dues, providing an extra financial incentive for workers to unionize. Workers have long been able to deduct union dues in some circumstances from their federal taxes before that deduction was eliminated when Trump was in office. That was part of the 2017 Republican tax bill. Now, the Democrats intend to at least reinstate the deduction, or depending on what the Senate parliamentarian thinks of all this, even create a refundable tax credit for money spent on union dues. Secondly, the Democrats intend to include civil penalties for violations of the National Labor Relations Act in the budget measure, a provision which would finally provide the NLRB with some real teeth. And that's needed. That measure is seen as having the best chance to clear the parliamentarian's watchful eye, since the money collected for violations would go straight to the NLRB, which is a federal agency. That's pretty clever. Pretty clever. Like I said, a lot has to be sorted out here, but at least things are moving in the right direction. And it's kind of odd, too, because usually bills start in the House and they go into the Senate, and for years they died in the Senate. This one made it through the Senate. Now it's got to go back to the House, and then they're going to try to tack on this reconciliation bill. President Biden is expected to sign a new executive order tomorrow to set a target that by 2030, at least 50% of the new vehicles sold in the country will be zero emission. Zero. The executive order will also include a schedule to develop fuel efficiency and emission standards for cars and trucks. Got a comment here from Scott Paul on this. And Scott's been on the show many times. He heads the Alliance for American Manufacturing. And he said the administration is right to take action to encourage the adoption of clean energy vehicles. But it's not enough to set purchasing targets. We also need to make serious investments to ensure that these vehicles, related supply chains, and the infrastructure needed to support them are made in America as well. He said, unfortunately, the United States already is laps behind countries like China when it comes to electric vehicle production. China heavily subsidizes its EV industry and controls the supply of many of the critical minerals and materials to power them, like rare earths. If the U.S. does not make the investments needed to kickstart our own EV industry now, guess what? We lose the race. He said the United States should not trade foreign oil for made-in-China EVs. The U.S. auto industry powers our country. It built the arsenal of democracy in World War II, and just last year stepped up to make PPE and other needed gear in response to the pandemic. We just can't afford to lose it. The EV future is here, and it's time to get to work to ensure its future is also made in America. He points out a recent study by researchers at Horizon Advisory found that China's government has deployed a four-pronged industrial strategy to dominate the global EV market, including through low-cost domestic production, inflating domestic demand, bringing in foreign technology and expertise, and acquiring foreign resources and brands. China, in so many ways, is our enemy, if you haven't figured that out by now. And we created them 20 years ago when we normalized relations. They subsidize these industries, and that's why so many corporations go there to get production done, because you just can't beat the prices and the low wages they pay their workers. We'll have to get Scott back on. Scott's a great guy. You want to find more about that, just go to AmericanManufacturing.org, AmericanManufacturing.org. So it's good that Biden's going to sign this executive order, but it needs to go a whole lot deeper than that. All right, we got to take a quick break here. When we come back, the food and commercial workers, Local 152. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy,
and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
Buildings, bridges, skyscrapers, and more. Structures that are the face of our cities and towns were built by members of the Iron Workers Union. That's why it's important that our workforce of over 130,000 iron workers continues to be the safest and best trained in the field. With 154 training centers, we invest over $90 million annually in safety and training. We're growing the next generation of union iron workers. There are so many reasons to put your trust in our iron workers and their employers. Learn more about us at ironworkers.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And we're back. Don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle, real simple, AWF Union Podcast, AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to line number one. Welcome a newcomer to the show. His name is Hugh Giordano. And Hugh comes from the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 152. He's based in New Jersey. Website is UFCWLocal152.org. And they represent 14,000 members in not just New Jersey, but also Delaware and a chunk of Pennsylvania. Hey, Hugh, welcome to America's Workforce. Did I pronounce your last name correctly? Giordano, is that right?
That is correct.
Good, good, good. Well, I read a little bit about your bio and your background before we started the show, but I'd like to hear from you. It sounds like you've been involved and interested in unions for, what is it, two decades now, going back to 2001. I'm just wondering what piqued your interest. I guess you were a student and you realized that unions might pave a better way for you. Is that kind of what happened?
Yes. I was always involved in the union conversation. My grandfather was an iron worker for Local 401. My mother was a UFCW member as a cashier at a supermarket. So I was always heard the conversation about unionization and what unions do. But I got involved when I was 17, when I worked at a non-union facility. And not only was I not treated well, but my coworkers at the time were not treated well either, whether it was wages and benefits and other types of treatments and working conditions. And I reached out at the time to UFCW Local 56, and that's how I started with the cafeteria workers at Philadelphia University. At the time, I was still in high school. So I got involved very early in organizing and understanding workers' rights, and it was kind of a maturing experience for me. You know, I always understood that, you know, job protections were important because of the way I grew up. But when I actually got involved in with the union organizing and understanding wages and benefits and how that affects working communities, it was an overnight experience, and I was 100% hooked to the movement since then.
That's awesome. You're 17, you're in high school, and you're organizing. Now, let me ask you, when you're in high school, you usually, you know, chase girls, play sports. You're doing union organizing. How did your fellow students feel about what you were doing at that time?
That's a good question. And you're absolutely right. I was involved. I had, you know, a regular social life. But once I got hooked on the organizing, it took over. And at the time, I remember having a girlfriend, and she would always say that if the labor movement, if the union was a girl, that I would cheat on her, because I was so into it. It was crazy how much I just fell for it, and how much I wanted to get involved. And it wasn't even like they begged me to get involved. I was drawn to it. You know, I think a lot of at this time, you know, being that age, a lot of younger people don't understand what a union is. But they supported me, you know, they knew I was into it. They knew the type of actions I was doing. And for being a regular working class kid in Philadelphia at the time, you know, it was a big deal. So I think most people were supportive of what I was doing.
Now, that organizing campaign that you did when you're 17, I would imagine that was a learning experience. Maybe you could reflect on that and tell us how difficult that was.
Absolutely. You know, it's amazing. When I first did it and we first started the conversations and got a committee together of workers and had the union meetings, you know, management at the beginning, again, being naive, I thought they would be supportive. Hey, you know, they're always talking about all these, you know, we care about the workers and we care about you, what you have to say. And I thought that, you know, once we filed for the election and they would be open to it. And it was a total opposite. They hired one of the largest anti-union law firms, consistent meetings, you know, of anti-union labor meetings with not only the administration, but of the law firm that they hired, you know, threats, coercion. It was a real learning experience. And if anybody's been through a union campaign, they understand the stress that can go with that. And you know, I was caught off guard as a young person. I won't lie about that. I was naive. I thought that there might be some good relations going forward after we filed for election, but it was the total opposite. So I learned real quick what big business is about, what the mindset of profit over people, and it woke me up immediately.
Well, you are certainly not afraid to take on challenges, because I'm reading a couple years later, you decided to get involved in politics and you ran for state rep in Pennsylvania. Now, I take it you didn't win that race. Is that right?
Yes. So one of the things that I think anybody that's involved in the labor movement understands that politics go hand in hand, right? And a lot of things that affect us, when whether it's organizing, whether it's collective bargaining rights, and other workers' rights that go along with that, you know, you have to get involved in the law so we can change it to make it better, to make it easier for workers to join a union, to make it easier for a first contract, you know, all those issues. And I had said to myself that while I was working my way through college, that once I got my master's degree, that I was going to run for office. And one of the things that I wanted to stress was workers' rights. At the time, I was not very happy with both parties. I was disappointed with both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. So I decided to run as an independent, a third-party candidate. And I wanted to really not be controlled. And the great thing about it was I got endorsements from local labor unions. I had a really strong ground game. I raised a lot of money. And even though I didn't win, I ran, my district was Philadelphia in the suburbs. I did end up getting almost 20% of the vote in a three-way race as an independent, which is really unheard of. Usually you only get 2 or 3% at the max.
Right.
I was 24 years old. So I wanted to just get out there and make a difference. I wanted to show that, you know, that working people can make a difference, that you don't have to be a millionaire. It was one of the, it was a great experience. And it really honed me and trained me for my future too, as a union representative. Because I have no fear talking to politicians. You know, I did the dance. I know what it's like behind the scenes. So it's a much easier conversation, and I think it made me a better union representative.
Do you think you'll do it again? What's your thoughts?
You know, I thought about it, and I guess the answer is yes. If I was given the opportunity and I felt it emotionally, I think anybody that knows, even if you're just running, if you're just helping a campaign, if you're involved, how much work it is. But when you're the candidate, and you're really trying to do a good job and run an efficient campaign and raise money and everything else in between, you know, you're basically saying, I'm going to give up my life altogether. And that includes, you know, your significant other, and other things that may be important to you. But I think it's who I am. I enjoy doing that type of work. And if it's going to change the system, if it's going to change the conversation, and it's going to help working people, yes, I would. Yes.
Well, let's talk about what you were able to do in the state of New Jersey. And it's my understanding that you helped pass some major, major labor legislation there to make it easier for workers to join a union, primarily the cannabis workers. And I know that's exploding around the country right now. But talk to me about what you did there, because it sounds pretty exciting.
Yes. Just to give you a little background, the UFCW has been involved with cannabis since the late 90s when California passed the medical. We were part of the ballot initiative, and we were part of the ground game to get that passed. Why? Because we knew that it would create good jobs. We knew that it was an industry that would be stable. And we got involved more so when we started seeing, at the time, the federal government was raiding legal medical facilities because it's federally illegal. And when people saw the news articles, it was always the headline was, you know, dispensary raided, cultivation site related raided, but it was the workers sitting on the sidewalk in zip ties. And that bothered us. So we started getting involved in the conversation nationally. In New Jersey, we got involved when Governor Corzine signed it into law before Governor Chris Christie got into office, because Governor Chris Christie was not only anti-union, but he was also anti-cannabis as well, even medical. So since the Chris Christie administration, we've been working with politicians, making sure that workers' rights were part of the any expansion of the program. And luckily for us, Governor Murphy is pro-worker and pro-cannabis. So we started talking and putting the pressure on. And in the updated and expanded medical program, we were able to get labor peace requirements in there to make it easier for workers to form and join a union from seed to sale. That was such a big win, because if folks don't understand that agriculture workers are exempt from the National Labor Relations Act. Right. And these companies are trying to say that these cultivation workers who are producing medicine and other adult use products, who use horticulture, botany, chemistry, and other forms of trades and sciences, are labeled ag workers. So on the federal level, they wouldn't be able to organize. So having those labor peace agreements not only allow dispensary workers and those other forms of workers to organize, but it also protects cultivation workers and allows them to organize under the law. So that was a big win. And it also took away what we all know to be true, the anti-union tactics. Labor peace agreements make it so that the company has to be neutral in the conversation, you know, have access so that we could talk to the workers in a neutral environment. And then it also holds us accountable as a labor movement that we're not going to badmouth the company. And we're going to move towards a partnership, labor and industry working together. And that was kind of the mindset of it, so that we could build a strong industry, so that we could set standards for workers and everything in between, job training, and really talk about other issues that affect the industry, specifically in social equity. And workers' rights and social equity are the main components, like we believe, when it comes to cannabis and workers' rights.
So, Hugh, how many workers are we talking about? And we do we have a contract in effect right now as we speak?
Yes. We actually do represent workers already in New Jersey. Our first facility that we organized in New Jersey was called the Garden State Dispensary. They have a cultivation site, and they have three dispensaries. And they are expanding, actually. And we just passed adult use. Our medical market is very small here in New Jersey, but the adult use bill has passed. That has labor peace language in it as well in New Jersey. And they're looking to give out hundreds of retail licenses. So it's going to boom. And around the country, we are organizing around the country as well, the UFCW. We represent some really big banners, such as MedMen, Jenny's. So these are big, have a heart. So we're moving in that direction to make sure that this industry is represented.
I have to ask you, because of your success over there in Jersey, is the national UFCW thinking about moving Hugh Giordano around the country because you're so good at it?
That's a funny question. I've already done some traveling. I'm currently being borrowed by the International Union. I've traveled to Washington State, and I travel all over the East Coast. And so currently, yes, I guess D.C. is already thinking the way you're thinking. I appreciate the compliment. I'm just a workhorse. You know, it's who I am. You know, I love this. I really do love the movement. I love what it stands for. And I love the fact that we have an opportunity here to have these hard conversations with not only state legislators, but also federal in regards to cannabis. And hopefully that puts more pressure not only, you know, when I look at cannabis, I look at, for example, the cultivation workers having the right to organize. To me, that opens the door up to, well, why shouldn't all agricultural workers have the right to organize? You know, so I think it's cannabis is going to help more than just cannabis workers. It's going to help other industries as well. And yeah. I think that hopefully we can keep on working together, the locals and Washington, D.C. And just a quick point, the AFL-CIO also gave the UFCW official jurisdiction in representing cannabis workers.
Good stuff to hear, I'll tell you. You are like a hungry dog, my man. I mean, holy smoke. 17. He's 17 in high school organizing workers, and now he's going around the country on behalf of the food and commercial workers. I want to talk about the PRO Act, because what you did in Jersey is very similar. It's almost like a mini PRO that was happening there. I want to get into that. Hugh Giordano, joining us on our live line, he's with Local 152, UFCW Local 152.org. That's their website. Represent 14,000 workers in New Jersey, Delaware, and Pennsylvania. We're talking cement later in the show with Brian Farmer, and he's going to talk about the careers that are exploding in that field. Back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Have you or a loved one been diagnosed with prostate, breast, or any other cancer after taking Zantac? You may be entitled to compensation. The trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at KellyandFerraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Nurses, doctors, and caregivers at the VA are under attack. They face hostile management, callous agency heads, and an administration that's stomping all over their ability to speak up for our veterans. Unions are even being kicked out of their offices, a direct attempt to silence the voice of VA employees. When VA workers are under attack, veterans pay the price. Costly privatization and outsourcing will run rampant, meaning fewer services and worse quality of care for our nation's heroes. It's time to stand up for the workers who care for our veterans. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit SurveyandBallotSystems.com to learn more.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, we are available on 5 platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. When you get an opportunity, just take a minute, sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis, and give us a rating. We'd appreciate a 5-star rating. Let's go back to our live line, rejoin Hugh Giordano. Hugh is an organizer with the Food and Commercial Workers, Local 152. That's UFCW Local 152.org. He's based in New Jersey. They represent about 14,000 workers in New Jersey, Delaware, and Pennsylvania. And Hugh, I want to talk to you about the PRO Act, and you're the perfect person to talk about the PRO Act because you're an organizer. You know how difficult. I mean, you're 17. You're in high school. You're organizing workers at, what, Philadelphia University. And you saw the injustices. But I'm just wondering how you feel. It passed in the House. Still stalled in the Senate. I'm hoping that we can somehow do it with, maybe if they get rid of the filibuster, we'll see what happens. Things are changing. I mean, we got the bipartisan infrastructure bill yesterday. So what do you think of the climate moving forward? Because I'm sure you're watching the polling and all this, and a majority of Americans would like to see more unions happen in America. Unions lift all boats, and when you go back to the 50s, when America was strong, when the middle class was strong, unions were strong. With all that being said, how do you feel about the PRO Act?
100% support it. The PRO Act, to me, I wish that we weren't even talking about the PRO Act, because I wish the Employee Free Choice Act would have been passed when we had the opportunity to do it. And, you know, it's a shame, because there's been so many campaigns that have happened around this country where a majority of the workers signed union cards and decided as adults that they wanted a union. And the one thing that there's many aspects of the PRO Act, but I think organizing is truly would change the dynamic if it was passed, specifically with the card check legislation. As we know, the public sector has card check. So why shouldn't the private sector? If workers make a decision based on their own education and research and conversations amongst friends and family, and even management and labor representatives, and they choose to sign a card, that should be it. And I think that the fact that the PRO Act would stop the intimidation, stop the mandatory meetings, and also allow workers to make a decision, make it binding and final, but, you know, without intimidation, is a huge step. And we would see a huge increase in workers who want to organize and get to the ability. And that's the thing, the ability to sit down with their employer and negotiate.
I'm sure you watch what happened in Bessemer, Alabama, with the vote for a union at Amazon. And it's my understanding that that may happen again. It's being discussed at the National Labor Relations Board as we speak. And they found a lot of improprieties there, especially with the mailbox right inside. Which wasn't supposed to happen. And apparently they worked with the post office to make sure it was placed in that strategic location for management. I'm just wondering, could that be the game changer we're looking at today? Because there are a lot of people watching what happened down there.
Yes. You know, and just to give a little plug on that, the RWDSU was the one who ran that campaign, and the RWDSU is part of the UFCW. Uh-huh. So we are very much involved in that. And you're right. I mean, it was ridiculous. The fact that the federal government assisted, in giving a mailbox right in front of the manager's office. And there was other conversations about Amazon putting a special tent over the, mailbox, and it's craziness. And you know, and the other thing that's really upsetting about that whole case, and I remember just from the beginning of it, is that they hired an ex-NLRB judge. So it's really, it's sad. It's just a sad what money can do and how low people's ethics and morals are. And I do think that it's an opportunity for the Biden administration to really put his money where his mouth is as far as make sure workers come first. And I think that this case is going to be huge. Hopefully the folks that are elected at the board will do the right thing, not only order a new election, but who knows? I mean, it would be really great if they ordered, which is very rare, I think it was a 10J, where they have to actually sit down and negotiate because the infraction was so horrible. But we'll see where it goes. I mean, you know, everything ends up in court. We all know how that is. But hopefully it sets a precedence for the future that it's unacceptable, and it's creates more conversation for the PRO Act as well.
Hugh, the other thing I want to point out about PRO, it would eliminate right to work. And currently there's, I believe, 27 states in America that have gone in that direction, which means they're getting union representation and they're not paying for it. It's a way to bankrupt unions. I'm just thinking what you have done, especially with the cannabis workers in New Jersey, that would have been almost impossible to accomplish if New Jersey was a right-to-work state, right? Am I assuming that?
Yes, you're absolutely right on that. It would have been really difficult, one, because the political atmosphere would have not been in our favor as far as workers' rights. Any state that usually has passed right-to-work usually has elected officials that are not open to conversations and changing those statutes. So most union representatives in right-to-work states have to spend their time going around and quote-unquote collect dues because they're not able to take it directly from people's paychecks and have that set up in a system where we could focus using the resources to talk to politicians, not only change laws in effect to right-to-work, but other labor laws to protect workers in many industries. So it takes away our resources and our time to do what our job is, and that's to voice concerns for working people, to enforce collective bargaining agreements, and to change the environment overall for working people. And it would have been nearly impossible if Right to Work was passed in New Jersey for me to have done the work that I have done, put the time in, and the resources. Because at the end of the day, our resources come from our members, and we make sure that we use our resources effectively to change their lives for the better.
Boy, I'm just thinking how unions would grow. There's been a number thrown around. 60 million people would join a union if they didn't have so many roadblocks to join a union. And your union, what, 14,000 members, could explode. I'm just wondering here, as an organizer, and just take the pro act out of it, though, because I know you've got a game plan for 5 years, 10 years, but as far as the growth, and obviously a lot of that's coming from the cannabis industry, any idea on where you might be in the next couple of years?
Sure. Well, you know, if things go right, if we look at just the cannabis industry itself, you know, we're looking at 150 possible retail locations and up to close to 40 cultivation sites. And a cultivation site has between 50 to 100 workers, and a retail dispensary has between 30 and 60 workers. So we're looking at a potential of thousands of workers who will have the opportunity to join the middle class. And also setting standards, because as I said, you know, this is a new industry, and even though it's booming now, it's still in its infancy. There's many states that don't have rules and regs yet, and there's many states that don't have functioning dispensaries or cultivation sites. So there's more to come, and we're hoping that what we're doing in New Jersey and New York and Connecticut, Virginia, California, and other states that have labor requirements in it, that will spread to other states down south as well, such as Georgia, Oklahoma, that have medical programs. And those workers know that they have the right to join a union, too.
I love it. Hugh, I'm going to leave it on that note. Very positive. Lots of energy from you. Hugh Giordano, organizer with the Food and Commercial Workers, Local 152. This is one guy to watch, I'm telling you. UFCW, local152.org for more information. You take care, my friends. Stay safe. Keep doing what you're doing. And stay in touch with us, okay? Let's check in a couple of months. I'm excited what you're doing in America, okay?
That sounds great. And thank you so much for what you do. You know, journalism is a real trade. And as a labor representative, thank you for taking the time to interview me on these important subjects.
You got it. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Brian Farmer is with the Cement Masons. He's coming up next on America's Workforce.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.
Mesothelioma is a rare type of cancer caused by exposure to asbestos. If you were exposed to asbestos and have mesothelioma or lung cancer, the trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Hire union musicians. Call Music Talent of Cleveland at 216-881-1802. Call Music Talent of Cleveland as your dependable source for professional musicians in Northeast Ohio. Union musicians add harmony to weddings, elegance to parties, and uplifting music for all events. Music Talent of Cleveland contracts solo and ensemble musicians as well as bands and orchestras for single engagements. So hire union musicians. Call Music Talent of Cleveland today. 216-881-1802.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at boydwatterson.com.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook. That's AWF Union Podcast. And follow us on Twitter. Same handle there, AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to line number two right now. Welcome to the show, Mr. Brian Farmer. Brian is the apprenticeship coordinator for Local 633 of the Operative Plasters and Cement Masons International, based in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Training, 633.org is their website. Brian, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you for having me on.
And you're telling me 1,000 members, and this is quite significant. This needs to be pointed out because we get a lot of the trades on the show, and the trades need new members, apprenticeship programs. Mm-hmm. And some are doing really well. Yours is doing extraordinarily well. You're telling me, what, 10% of your membership are apprentices? That's right. Maybe you could break that down for us, Brian.
Yes, sir. So with some of our retirees working also their allotted hours, we're floating in around about 1,000 members. 10% of that pool is our apprentices. And this year has just been phenomenal. We're floating right now around 120 apprentices. And even in that number, 10% of that number are females. So it's just excellent. The demand is here. The workload is here. In Minnesota right now, we're just booming from one end of the state to the other. And this is going to be an exciting year.
Okay. Now, is this all Brian Farmer doing great outreach or what? And how are you getting all the females attracted to be cement masons? What's the story here?
You are correct. We do a lot of outreach. We do a lot of, we actually do a MnDOT tribal program also with the tribes. And we do a MnDOT deed program. These seem to be our great outreaches. And the MnDOT deed one is our women and minority group. We had just completed both of those pre-apprenticeships or industry orientations, whatever you want to think about or call them. But every single participant in both of those groups are now placed and they're working right now. So, I mean, just that part of life change is pretty awesome.
And now we have what appears to be an infrastructure bill that passed the Senate. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're aware of that. It still has to go to the House. Don't you think, Brian, that this is just going to open door? I mean, roads, bridges. Hey, we're talking cement here. I mean, we're going to need some workers. What's your opinion on that moving forward?
It's kind of crazy because we boomed all the way through the pandemic. I believe we had about 1.4 million worker hours last year in this pandemic. Now you throw the infrastructure bill on here, I think things are just going to be insane. And I think the realization of you know, no student debt, apprenticeships don't cost you anything. And these participants or workers are walking into $80,000, not even including their benefits as a starting pay. I think that's just very, very attractive to all, and they see all the workload going on right now. And you throw in all of the work that's coming through this infrastructure bill, it's going to be crazy.
Let's explain what cement masons do. I think a lot of people are saying, they're pouring concrete, they're doing a driveway or something like that, or a street or something. It is definitely more than that. And I think this is a good opportunity for you, Brian, to explain what a person would learn in an apprenticeship program with the cement masons.
Sure. So we have expectations of what we think a first, second, and third year apprentice should know to be successful in the field. So as a first year, we're working their basic hand mechanics and layout. Also, we do set our forms. We like you said, we're pouring our roads, bridges, curb and gutter from stadiums to high rises, everything you can think of. We're not really into the residential scene much, so the houses and whatnot. We really don't have a lot of contractors that do that, so we're big league stuff. Like I said, our hospitals, colleges, stadiums, roads, bridges, and everything in between. Actually, our work jurisdiction is huge as far as polished concrete, the decorative side of what we do too, cementitious overlays, coatings. I mean, it's a ton that we try to jam in up here. But back to what they're learning, the first year is pretty basic, working their hand tools, understanding the progression, understanding the mix designs. Currently in Minnesota, we have roughly 2,000 different mix designs. A lot of people think concrete's just, you know, rock, sand, and Portland cement. You add a little water, and there you go. Well, yeah. It's a lot more complicated than that with all of our applications and admixtures. But then as a second year, we start really diving into the construction math side of what we do, percentages of slope, volumetric equations, deciphering blueprints. The third year apprentices also, we kind of step it up with the technology side with total station layout, understanding, you know, more of the print parameters with Procore and PlanGrid, and then a lot more hand mechanics as far as, of course, working their tools, but working more of the walk-behind power trowels of riders, understanding polished concrete. So it's a lot we try to jam in up here, and usually these kids are walking out of here with a brain swell, but that's kind of our job, and that's what we do.
I'm wondering if you could speak to the differences between male and female in learning this craft, and it's great. Again, it's awesome that 10% of your apprentices are female, and then you're branching out, you're people of color, because a lot of folks today, especially as to your point on the pandemic, frontline workers, they weren't making much. They say, you know what, I'm not gonna do this the rest of my life. I need a career, and this is a perfect opportunity for that. But as far as that, the learning between male and females, you notice any differences there?
I do, and I have five kids. One of them is a girl, and she was very much more tedious and thoughtful. I didn't have to repeat the same thing three times. I see that with our female workers, they are very detail oriented, very tedious. You know, the males might exceed in the physical side of it, but I think a lot of our females might have stepped back from this at first because they thought it was too physically demanding. I mean, it's an all day grind on our bodies. We're working with a time sensitive material every day, but sure. Our females are they're just phenomenal. So if there's detail oriented work, it seems like they grasp the technology piece a little faster and the blueprints a little faster. But if I was to put them on something very tedious and meticulous, it seems like our females are knocking it out of the park. And they see that they have, you know, a market share in this with the guys. It's just not a guy-driven industry. So yeah. It's awesome to see all these females coming into our craft and all the building trades crafts. It's just a good thing to see.
Yeah, I know nationwide, it's like 2-3% female, maybe a little bit higher now. But when you told me 10%, that's great. I said this guy's got to be doing something right, and I think it's going to explode here even more so. Like I referenced the infrastructure bill, because there are jobs available, and again, we're talking good paying jobs, great wages, great benefits, pensions. You don't get that opportunity in so many different career paths today. So right. It's so important that people understand what the trades are offering. Well, I want to drive people to your website, training633.org. That's training633.org. We're talking the Operative Plasters and Cement Masons International. Brian Farmer is the apprenticeship coordinator at Local 633. Sounds like you're doing the right things. Keep in touch with us and stay safe, okay, buddy?
Hey, thank you, and thanks for having me on, my friend.
You got it. All right, that's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, the Milwaukee Building Trades and the United Auto Workers. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.